Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Tuesday, October 31st, 2023. It's Halloween and the end of October and the end of the first third of the last quarter. So we are very much into the end game with respect to the financial time of 2023, and lots of news to talk about today. Thank you so much for tuning in to WVW-TV. We really appreciate your viewership and your support. We also appreciate the fact that we're able to bring you some excellent programming and alternative thought and viewpoints at no charge. There's no paywall, and of course, there's no subscription. And as a result of that, you're able to tune in and hear viewpoints that you're probably not going to see on mainstream TV. But we're here and we're broadcasting, and we're very thankful for our First Amendment rights in this country that allow us to express viewpoints and points of interest that tend to deviate from the narrative that you hear on the mainstream. So anyway, thank you for tuning into WVW-TV, and thank you for supporting WVW-TV as well. As you know, because we're not a commercial network, we don't sell advertising, and there's no commercials to interrupt our fine programming, but we do... really appreciate any gifts and donations and support that you can give to keep our programming on the air. We're also thankful for our sponsors because they do a great deal of work to keep us broadcasting free information. The sponsor for my program, as you probably all now know, is Swiss America Trading, which is a great company out of Arizona. And Swiss America is a purveyor of precious metals. So if you're looking at possibly expanding your portfolio of investments and you're thinking about buying some actual tangible, touchable metal, precious metal, you certainly would want to give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them for some free investor information. They're happy to send it out. The information explains how one goes about buying tangible precious metals and the pros and cons and why these things make good investments, and they're happy to send that to you. You can also go to their website, which is SwissAmerica.com. And if you use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, if you use the promo code Eastman, then they will send you that free information as well. And, of course, you will be able to shop around and look around online and see what they have to offer. And primarily, Swiss America is a purveyor of precious metals in various forms. You can buy gold bullion coins or silver or platinum bullion coins. You can buy blocks and bars of bullion. And of course, you can buy numismatics, which are collectible coins as well. And all three of those have a place and a market. And of course, if you're interested in diversifying your holdings, that's a great company to work with because they've been in the space a long time and they know what they're doing and they're professional and trustworthy. And if you're interested in buying gold, silver, platinum, whatever, you should give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. And importantly, there is, for all the bad news we talk about in the economy, there is some sort of a silver lining. And Swiss America right now is offering a special on standing Liberty half dollars. These are silver coins minted by the U.S. government. They're bullion coins, and they're minted to certain specifications so that you know you're getting a certain amount of silver in each coin. And these are being offered right now by Swiss America at $13.50 each, and that includes shipping, which is a great deal because if you buy online, you know shipping is a big part of the decision making, and free shipping is always a real blessing. So if you're interested in adding silver to your holdings, this is a great time to call Swiss America and take advantage of the $13.50 special, including shipping. And there's a few limitations. You can only buy up to 250 coins per person. And this $13.50 special will run until they're out of inventory and then it's over. So if you're thinking about what to give your old Uncle Joe or your nephews or nieces for the holiday season, the gift-giving season is upon us, this is a great idea to think about maybe giving somebody tangible precious metals as a gift, which will, theoretically go up in value as inflation continues, rather than something that'll end up in a landfill or long forgotten. I mean, it's pretty hard to forget when old, you know, your aunt or your uncle or parents or whoever friends gave a gift of a precious metal, because metals are precious because throughout history, people have found them to be precious because they tend to be valuable from generation to generation. If you look at the periodic table of elements, you get a little academia here. The metals, gold and silver, platinum, those are called the noble metals on the periodic table of elements, and they're called that for a reason. It's because these are the metals that have preserved and stored wealth for a very long time. Since the beginning of humanity, people have found that gold and silver don't deteriorate. They tend to hold their shape and size, and that means that it's an excellent vehicle for the storing of value. And that's why people buy tangible precious metals. So if you're interested in adding your collection or starting your collection or giving a collection to somebody else, give Swiss America a call and see what they have. You know, go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, shop around and see what the bargains are. But take a look at that $13.50 special because it's got the free shipping. And I'll tell you, metals are heavy, and if somebody ships it to you for free, that's worth noting. Anyway, thank you, Swiss America. We appreciate your sponsorship, and give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. Okay, let's jump into the news. We are here in America waiting with bated breath to see what our Federal Open Market Committee is going to be up to starting tomorrow, November 1st, and into November 2nd, where they meet in Washington and they have lots of discussions and great lunches, and then they vote, and then they decide whether or not to raise the interest rates in another attempt to pull the punch bowl back from the edge of the table to slow down the party. And of course, we've been watching our Federal Reserve do that, exercising its monetary policy, its monetary authority to raise and lower interest rates for the very purpose of speeding up or slowing down our national economy. And of course, that's my big ball over here, the GDP, the gross domestic product, the free market. And that ball kind of expands and contracts. And of course, when it gets expanding a little too fast and prices start to go up, that is inflation. And of course, that hurts a lot of people in the country. So the Fed's theory is, okay, well, let's contract the ball. How do we do that? Well, we can order the factories to shut. That would do it, but that's politically not good. So what do? They play around with the financial side, the monetary policy, with the thinking that, if we raise interest rates because we control all the money, then it'll get more costly to borrow, and businesses will back away from, borrowing to buy that next truck or that next lathe or that next shelving unit or the next put up another building. We'll contract the economy from the business side down. And of course, when you raise interest rates, you're also burning the consumer because the credit card interest rates go up and automobile loan interest rates go up, and of course, mortgage interest rates go up. And it has a wet blanket effect on my big, beautiful global or national economy. And that's what they're going to be debating tomorrow. Now, we've talked about the issue, the phenomenon, I guess you could say, that with our federal government spending a massive deficit amounts, and this was something that only happened like in World War II, and there's only extraordinary circumstances that would allow the federal government to go into debt for the protection of all of us. Well, this has become the norm. And of course, if you take a look at the numbers that they're spending, I saw an interesting little blip here today. The projected federal government borrowing in Q3, which we are in Q4 right now. So Q3 was they borrowed $1 trillion, and that's a lot of money. And in Q4, we've just finished October, or we'll have by 5 o'clock tonight. They are looking at 1.5 trillion in additional borrowing, and then we're looking into Q1, January, February, March of 2024, and they're looking at another projected 1.5 trillion in borrowing. And of course, we already have $33 trillion in debt on the U.S. balance sheet. This is going to be somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion, depending when you stop and start counting, of additional debt that just keeps piling and piling and piling. We seem to have hit a point in federal spending where we have delinked spending from the tax base. And this is problematic because in a Adam Smithian world, you'd look at this big ball of the GDP, and I mentioned this before, the government would be elected by we the people with this idea that maybe we ought to have some infrastructure and some public safety net and some protections. So let's tax from the big ball and spend. And if you think about it, we take dollars out of the big ball, we run it through our government to direct the spending, and then it gets spent. So the ball size never changes. It's just the big ball. But the individual decisions, if you tax somebody and take some of their money away, they don't get to decide how to spend it. The government does. But because we have a government that is elected by we the people, we kind of all own the government, whether your party's in power or not. You know, the fact is, this is how we have agreed to set ourselves up as a society, because we have a constitutional republic. It's been around since 1783-89 when it was ratified, and this is the deal. You live in America, this is how it works. Okay, this is the only deal. There are no other deals. And this is what happens. We have a government and it has taxing power, and our tax system is, of course, voluntary. So if you'd like to voluntarily not pay your taxes, they will voluntarily haul you off to the hooskow. You got to pay your taxes. So the point is, they tax and they spend, and this would keep our ball buzzing along. And of course, the only hurt is the people in the ball that get taxed. And then the government puts up a bridge, and then the guy says, well, I don't want a bridge. I'd rather swim across the river. I don't want a highway. I like dirt paths better. There's always the curmudgeon who would rather not have any infrastructure. But the reality is, this is how governments work. Okay, so when we look at this idea of, well, then how do you get to $33 trillion in debt? And then that's a good question, because if you think of the Adam Smithian world, which I was describing as this private sector ball, and government, you know, steps in, takes money and allocates it for the public good, the public betterment, to the disconcertation of the curmudgeons, of course, and to the enthusiastic cheers of those who benefit from the bridge or the highway. And how do you get to $33 trillion in debt? I mean, if you just tax and spend, where does that debt come from? Now, the private sector, of course, borrows, and that's how it grows. Because when you think about my big private sector ball, you have businesses and individuals, and there's people are earning money, and there's businesses earning profits, and the money just is circles and circles and circles, like the velocity model from what's his name, Milton Friedman here in my library, Milton Friedman, and this idea of velocity of money. And businesses and individuals and, of course, banks step into that as intermediaries that takes excess surplus from those who have it, savings, and then it puts it in the bank, and then the bank lends it and becomes investment. So savings equals investment is a classic formula within classical economics. So again, where do you get to the $33 trillion in debt from the government? And that becomes the big mystery, because in a perfect world, the Adam Smithian free market, laissez-faire world, the free market will govern itself, and there will be banks, and there will be businesses, and there will be workers and individuals, and of course there will be corruption, and there will be failure, and there will be good business ideas and bad, and that's what free markets do. They purge out all the companies that had a bad business model. The revenues minus expenses model was deficient and they lost money. Or people stop buying buggy whips or whatever, but that's the free market. And that market, I postulate, exists notwithstanding whatever we have today. So how do you get to the $33 trillion in debt? Okay, well, let me just keep going here. The government not only has tax and spend, but there's also this altruistic idea of social justice and virtue and people should play nice in the sandbox. And the government also has the ability, we've given it that authority, we the people, you know, through our Congress and our president and our court system, have granted the government authority to be the referee of the big ball. And it's like you watch a football game, the guys running around in a little white hat and striped shirts, and the basketball game, and of course everybody knows the umpire, the ball, you know, the baseball game. There's a referee process, and that's where regulation steps in to the big ball of the free market economy. Okay, so now you've got the government that does the tax and spend based upon the collective wisdom we need a bridge or a highway. And we have the regulation where we say, well, we really ought to not let the companies dump a lot of stuff in the rivers because we're trying to drink the water and all you get is industrial chemicals, you get sick, you pollute the ground, you pollute the air, you pollute the water. You can't run factories where, you know, something happens and 28 people die in a factory accident or somebody gets their hand chopped off. There's rules. If you're going to play in the big ball, there's going to be rules. If you're going to play in the Super Bowl, there's going to be rules. You know, and a lot of, you know, ultra conservative minds are thinking, well, there should be no rules. There should be no, you know, taxes, no nothing. But the reality is, in a structured 6 billion person globe, there's tax and spend, and there's regulation, and that's good, because ultimately, I mean, you know, every business person will tell you, I hate regulation, they're too much, they're too intense, or this or that, and oftentimes they are. They grossly exceed what is reasonable to advance social policy that is not approved by the mass in Congress. You know, they tend to try to use the regulatory mechanism to move an agenda forward that we the people have not voted on. And I think that really rubs a lot of people the wrong way. We're in that mess. Okay, so where do you get to the $33 trillion? Okay, so we've got tax and spend on good stuff, or at least popular stuff. And then we've got, you know, everybody has to play nice and do things the right way. How do you get to this $33 trillion? And of course, that is where the Keynesian model stepped in the 1930s, because prior to that time, the Adam Smith view that there is an economy, and the economy is a free market, and people, if left to their own devices under the Adam Smith's theory, will do things for their benefit and the benefit of others. Now, Adam Smith was a student of theology, okay? He spent a lot of time studying in the ministry, and maybe his worldview was a little less jauntist of, you know, man's evil, you know, man's human nature is not necessarily prone to being Christ-like, okay? It's more prone to being, you know, self-serving. But all right, so where do you get to the $33 trillion, okay? Well, that's where the Keynesian model comes in. So after the Great Depression, you know, the debt rise of the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, and the blowout in October 29th, actually it was a couple days ago, the anniversary, and the collapse of the stock market and the ensuing monetary policy that led to the Great Depression, suddenly you're staring into the abyss where this big ball, because it can do it to itself. I mean, left to its own devices, this thing could, you know, be like the Big Bang Theory. It would blow off into infinity. The problem is when it had it one of its, you know, explosions, the monetary policy, because the Fed was created in 1913, but the monetary policy in effect in 1929 into the 1930s, the Fed had some experience under its belt. And of course, it was a new agency, it was a new idea. The federal government did not have a central bank prior to this time. And as they were learning how to control the levers of monetary power, it didn't go real well, and that Great Depression lasted a long time. So as from congressional perspective and the presidential perspective, you're looking at an American economy that was, you know, the Roaring Twenties and a great big, you know, explosion on Wall Street, metaphoric explosion on Wall Street with the collapse of the stock market on October 29th and 30th of 1929, and then the economy just falls off the rails. And, you know, Congress by that time is like, well, what do we do? What do we do? I mean, we can't just let everybody starve to death. And people were. I mean, you think about the poverty in the Great Depression. This is before technology. It was actually before the mobilization era where people had cars, and cars were becoming a thing, and petroleum was available, but people were still very much, you know, heating their homes and illuminating their homes with oil lamps at the same time. And that was the whole idea of the 1930s, the rural electrification program. If you lived in the cities, you had electricity and natural gas, you know. You lived on the sticks and you're still burning candles and oil and, you know, driving this, you know, jalopy. It was a much less technologically advanced time. And it had impact on the population in a broad base. Then add to that, not only Congress's need to try and help the people, because that's kind of like why you have bother with a government to begin with, is to have, you know, somebody do something when times are tough, but you also add the emergence of mass communication through Marconi and radio. Basically what happened was, you know, the idea of AM radio showed up on the scene. And not only did we have some fabulous entertainers with the, you know, the old radio stars of the past, But you also had President Roosevelt with his fireside chats talking about, yeah, things are going to be better. They're really bad now, but they're going to get better soon. Just keep voting for me. And of course, all of the news and all of the ability to bring a United States of America that was geographically very different and bring it into the beginnings of a homogenous society. So somebody in New York could be talking to somebody talking in the radio and somebody in California hearing this. And suddenly you're starting to unite the United States culturally through the ability to communicate nationwide. Well, that became a real problem because you not only were communicating, the economy and entertainment and whatever and news, but you were also communicating the idea that times were tough and people needed solutions, and only the federal government could bring those solutions to you. And of course, that is when the model, because the same thing was happening in the United Kingdom in a probably a smaller scale because it was a smaller country. But John Maynard Keynes emerged as an intellectual thinker from one of the great universities, and he started talking about the Keynesian multiplier and this idea that if a government just taxes and spends, you can build a road and a highway. And of course, as the ball is now collapsing into the 1930s, the Great Depression, the ball's getting smaller and smaller. Factories are closing, massive layoffs, massive unemployment. If you dust off an old history book, you'll see a black and white photograph of people standing in line in a soup kitchen and all. Well, the ball is shrinking. So what do? How do you tax more and spend more from a shrinking ball? I mean, tax rates are starting to really rise. You got a real problem because same like today. I mean, your need to spend is vastly larger than the ability of the ball to pay taxes to support the dreams of of spending. So what happened, of course, is that there was an argument that the federal treasury should go out and borrow money and spend that too. Okay, that's the Keynesian multiplier. Tax and spend, and then go borrow some money and spend, and you get $2 of public spending for every dollar taxed. What could possibly go wrong, right? Well, here we are, that's the 1930s, and we're only 90 years away from that. It's hard to believe, but 90 years ago, I mean, this is 1923, and in 1933, we were in the depths of the Depression. So that was 90 years ago. Well, the idea is use this Keynesian multiplier. Well, America being a very conservative place was like, wait a minute, we can't, how can you borrow and spend and multiply the tax and spend? And how do we pay it back? I mean, if the ball continues to shrink, the debt will grow to infinity, maybe $1 million. It's not $33 trillion. How do we pay that back? And that became the real debate, and it was a huge debate in Congress. A lot of people said, no, we're just going to have to, tighten the hatches, and we're going to have to hunker down and ride this one out. Well, obviously what happened, and that debate was not settled in the 1930s. And Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, not Theodore, but FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his cousin. Interesting how some families have a monopoly on the White House, or at least the, capture. Anyway, the point is they went and were trying to do programs that would stimulate the economy. And that's where we got the Work Projects Administration, WPA. And they ran around, they built up, city halls and swimming pools, and they did public works, and the army of unemployed would be able to get paid to do work, because no, there was no free lunch back in those days. So you get a WPA job and give you some money, and then you build a swimming pool. Like in our community, the swimming pool and city hall were built by WPA dollars, and they're still here. I mean, it's how frugal we are. It's only 90 years old. What the heck? It's still good. The point is, that's how they viewed this idea of bringing the economy back. And there's a lot of debate. And at this point in time, central planning, people would go over to the Soviet Union and marvel at how their central planned government was going to blow us, leave us in the dirt. And at the end of the day, the thing that came along that really changed the paradigm after quite a decade of Americans hunkering down and frankly suffering and just living modest lives was World War II, that ramped up not only production. First of all, you take this army of unemployed people, you ship them off to two fronts. Now they're out of the country, which is bad. Then you have to ramp up the economy because we need all these, you know, war implements to make this thing work. And of course they did that. And of course, full employment, first of all, you had, you know, unemployment disappeared instantly, and anybody who could turn a screwdriver was working. And at the end of the day, that basically lifted the United States out of the conundrum of the Great Depression. And borrowing went through the roof. And we were selling war bonds. They had done this during World War One. You could buy a bond and can the Kaiser, grow vegetables, whatever. But at the end of the day, the die was set by 1945. The Keynesian model was in place. The United States economy was the biggest, strongest, because we didn't have all our cities and manufacturing bombed. So at the end of the day, you've got a very powerful economy in 1945, 1946. And the fear in Washington and academia was very real that we would slip right back into the Great Depression, because you have all these soldiers coming back to the United States and they're all looking for work. Well, all the factories are laying off because, you know, the war production had gone and fallen through the floor. What do you do to stimulate the economy? Well, this was the magic bullet for Keynesian borrow and spend. Because from that point on, first of all, we had borrowed crazy during the Great Depression, but it was very politically unpopular. World War II came along, and boy, we couldn't borrow enough to, you know, to beat the enemy. And then after the war, that model was, it was, oh, look, it works. Borrow money and spend it, you know, just tax and spend, borrow and spend, the Keynesian multiplier, and off it went. And it's been going that way until today. And now we have $33 trillion in debt because you never get out of the hole. Well, back in the Depression, when people were starving to death in World War II, we didn't know. I mean, would the world change and the U.S. be invaded or whatever? It was scary times. But then it became borrow for the comfort. We want to build an interstate highway system. We want to build infrastructure, airports, because, you know, nobody had flown. Flying was a curiosity until after World War II. That's when commercial aviation took off. Radio, television, commercial aviation, the mobilization of Americans, where everybody was buying a car. Suddenly we entered into a modern new era, and we can't think of this Adam Smith guy walking around the 1700s, you know, thinking about, you know, laissez-faire, and, you know, in the long run we hit equilibrium, and Keynes is, you know, in the long run we're all dead, we got to borrow money. It became the norm, and here we are. We have seen this progression, you know, from the Korean conflict after World War II, to the disaster in Vietnam, and then, you know, then came the 80s and 90s and all of the, you know, the wild that went with that. And, you know, here we are today, and it's just borrow and spend. And this whole idea of the tax and spend concept of a government where we take some money out of the big ball of economics and we spend it on public goods is long gone. Now it's just a matter of, we can manage the debt because we can manage the debt service. But the reality is, like any household, and we're seeing that today in the federal government, we're approaching, you know, well, I think we've blown past the $1 trillion mark in debt service on the outstanding debt. And as interest rates continue to rise based on market factors, as well as the Federal Reserve tweaking around tomorrow and the next day, that number only gets bigger. And at some point, you are going to find yourself in a situation where every last tax dollar is spent on interest on the money we borrowed over the last 90 years. And this is not a good place to be. So the question is, what do you do about it? How do you fix this? You're not going to slam the brakes and tax $33 trillion out of the GDP, because that happens to be larger than our GDP. So, you know, you're going to basically work everybody for free for 5 years to pay off the debt and start over, and then they'll start borrowing the next day. It becomes problematic. So if you look at other countries, ultimately what happens is countries inflate their way out and then they remonetize. And I think that's where you have to be observant to that as an American. Is that we're caught ourselves in a trap here, and there's going to be a way out. You know, the lights will, you know, what is it, the sun will come out tomorrow, as little Orphan Annie would sing, or her adopter is, you know, Daddy Warbucks, kind of interesting. But the point is, there will be a tomorrow, and you want to be on the better side of that tomorrow rather than the victim, because society needs to move. And if you're not in the right place, society is going to roll you over like a steamroller. And that's why you want to be thinking about tangible assets and get out of debt and get yourself in a position where when the tide comes in, your boat is floating and it's not tethered to the bottom of the sea or the harbor. Anyway, so this is all I have for today. We will look forward to the Fed meeting tomorrow. Thank you so much for watching Eastman Financial Report and WVW TV. We really appreciate it. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye.